Our message this morning comes from Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 through 5. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality." And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. Please be seated.
Usually when people share their devotional with me, they don't read out of this particular chapter. But there are so many wonderful things in this chapter because it is warning us and it is revealing to us things that so easily allure us. We're so easily dissuaded, aren't we, and persuaded to do the wrong things. And we realize that there is a force and a power that is at work. What is interesting about the book of Revelation is that Revelation puts a face on it, whereas the tendency is to think of something basically innocuous because, what's the big deal about going out and partying with the friends. And God says, okay, so you didn't see the face. So what he does is he gives you the face. And you go, well, that's a monster. And he goes, right, it's a monster. You see that, and it really, there's a parallel passage to this, and it's already been introduced to us in Revelation chapter 13, and it begins to describe this beast that is coming out of. And when you see the description of the beast, you can't help but then parallel that to Daniel, and you realize this beast is a conglomerate of all the nations that have ever existed as world powers. And God says, right. And you need to know that they are beasts, because they're here to devour you. They're not here to help you. They're not here to make you feel better. They're not here to protect you. That's a beast that's here to devour you. So the interesting description as he starts off in chapter 13 and then picks up again as we come now to chapter 17. As we've been going through the bowls of the wrath of God, what we've been seeing is what angers God. And what we've seen is really the things that have caused pain and hurt and heartache and division and strife throughout the years. And the bowls are just revealing that. God also has revealed to us that it was his desire to forgive these things, and probably one of the greatest reasons why you would be so upset is because you could have been saved. I would have gathered you. I could just hear Christ say that. I would have gathered you as a hen gathers his chicks, but you wouldn't have me. And the sadness of that and the anger that comes from somebody rejecting, as the way it's put in 2 Thessalonians 2, the love of the truth so as to be saved. Why would somebody reject the love of the truth when you could be saved? And that's the great consternation within the passage. As we come to this passage in this text, we begin to realize that there's a tie to the end of chapter 16 to the beginning of chapter 17. And that is that you have the seventh angel that pours out that seventh bowl at the end of chapter 16. And what happens, if you look with me in particular in verse 19, as a result of that, is the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations, which is now describing to us really what Babylon is. Babylon is the cities of the nations. That's the forces that have influenced us. And the places that we oftentimes run to as safe harbor, but really are the places of deception to us. So the way it reads is the cities of the nations fell, and Babylon the Great was remembered before God. Now, as you drop on down to chapter 17 and verse 1, it starts off this way, and one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the judgments of the great harlot who sits on the many waters." Of course, ultimately, verse 5, it's Babylon the Great. So the tie is this, and probably, you know, it can be read actually this way, and the ones of the seven angels who had the seventh bowls spoke to me. So it's this angel that is actually revealing to us this final judgment of Babylon. And it is God's anger, really, over the seduction of his people. And the fact that there is a seducing and intoxicating influence that is coming in, trying to allure his people away from him. Really, if you were to put the whole thing in a nutshell, it really is seen very clearly in James chapter 4, and in particular verse 4, as he says in that particular text, "Don't you know that friendship with God is like an adulterous relationship?" You're having an adulterous relationship. I mean, you should be, don't you love God? So John will say in 1 John chapter 2, "Love not the world." Don't fall in love with the world, because you're having a loving affair with the wrong one. You love the wrong person. So when it talks about things like adultery and harlotry, what it's talking about specifically is that you've played the harlot, you've gone from God, and you've gone into other things. You've literally sold yourself to the things of the world, and you've allowed the things of the world to allure you. As we come to this passage, the tie in all of this, of course, and lest you forget and get so immersed in the imagery that you miss the point, the tie in all of this is that this is written to the church. Now, the point of this is that there's an arsenal of the world that endeavors to marginalize, mask, eradicate the church. The world is not going to be happy till it closes the doors of the church. This is why this practice run was so important as we took a stand, because we were not going to let the world close the door to the church. That's what the world wants to do. And it wants to, it'll start off by marginalizing, by saying, well, it's not really that important. You don't really have to be there. But then it'll mask you. It'll shut you up. But then ultimately the desire is to eradicate it. All of these things are happening as a result of the allurement of the church, and it's very easy for the church to get allured into the world's way of thinking. And so the picture is that you have this great allurement that is calling the church out and away. This is why Scripture will say, you know, you got to get out of there. And in particular, if you look with me in chapter 18, just by way of reminder, it says in chapter 18, if you drop it down to verse 4, dealing with Babylon, by the way, it says in verse 4, "And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins, that you may not receive her plagues." And we know that he's talking about Babylon, verse 2, fallen is Babylon, in a passage. And you can virtually hear the same words in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 14 as you go to the end of the chapter. He says you got to get out of there. Come out from among and be separate. Don't be a part of these things, because the world is trying to shut the church doors. And it's causing this to happen by virtue of the church becoming like the world. And how does that happen? Well, all these allurements begin to come in. This is the tie, because once again, what is this book? Who is this book written to? The seven churches of Asia Minor. Right. Don't take my word for it. Go back. Chapter 1. And we'll just read verse 4. John, So the revelation of Jesus Christ starts off verse 1. Verse 4, John to the seven churches that are in Asia, grace to you and peace. Who is he writing to? The seven churches that are in Asia, who are representative of the churches of the world, or the churches of this day and age, even today. So he's writing to us. Why is he telling the church this? So they don't go in the tribulation? No, it has nothing to do with whether or not the church goes in tribulation or doesn't. It has everything to do with showing the church the face of evil. So this particular picture, as we come into chapter 17, is the face of the allurement that comes in and the picture of it. This picture has been being fostered throughout Scripture. And in particular, and we've looked at some of the passages. In fact, just take a moment and go to Proverbs in chapter 6, if you would, with me. If there were to be a theme, or one of the themes, one of the great themes of the book of Proverbs, is that this is a book of wisdom written to the naive. And the hope is we're going to suck the naivety out of the naive, right? Because he's just full of it. And the picture, of course, is found in chapter 7 of just how stupid he is. You know, the very place that he shouldn't be walking by is the very place that he goes. And he buys it hook, line, and sinker, the whatever words that are being said, because she's so pretty, because she's, you know, he's promising all kinds of things. And so, you know, he's not thinking. He doesn't know that he's like a lamb to the slaughter. He's not thinking. So, but it's described probably best in this short passage, so we don't spend a lot of time going into that. But if you look in Proverbs chapter 6, and the description is in the warning in verse 24. Of course, if you back up to verse 20, my son, observe the commandment of your father, don't forsake the teaching of your mother. So you kind of have this conference of mom and dad going, okay, we got to warn you about this. You drop on down to verse 24. To keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress, do not desire her beauty in your heart. Do not let her catch you with her eyelids. Yeah, even back then they were doing that. For on account of a harlot, one is reduced to a loaf of bread. She just sees you as money. She just sees you as something that's a commodity. An adulteress hunts for the precious life. You can't take this fire and not get burned. You're going to get burned on this one. So, interesting passage of description. And, of course, as Proverbs goes on to say, you can see the allurement of this woman and how the naive so easily go in to the clutches. And really, as Scripture goes on to say, you know, her bed is in Sheol. She's going to kill you. And you're gonna die going down this path. So as we come to chapter 17, it is that personification that is already understood within the passage. And what it does is it puts a face on the allurements of the world. Now we know, according to 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, that in the last days, perilous times will come. And here's the description. Men will be lovers of self and lovers of money. Now it goes on and describes a lot of other things, but those are going to be the great allurements. What you know is that that self-gratification is what people basically live for. And greed and avarice is certainly a part of the draw of men. I mean, you wave a dollar bill. It's strange what people will do for money, isn't it? I see this thing and go, really? You would risk your life for that? I mean, I can understand, you know, risking your life to go to mission field or something like that, but for money, really? People do all kinds of, and they'll embarrass themselves tremendously for money. All you have to do is offer them, you know, would you do this strange thing? Oh, no, I'd never do that. How about for $1 million? Well, maybe, yeah. This almost instantly changes at that particular point. So in chapter 17, he starts off with, you know, the seventh angel being connected with that Babylon and the splitting up. And, of course, we talk specifically about the influences of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. And if you think about it, that's the thing that splits when you think of the influences of Babylon. Those are things that are the influences, the three influences of the city, great city of Babylon. It is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life that bring in that destruction in people's lives. It's an interesting picture. But as it goes on, it says, the angel then comes and he says, come here, if you look in the passage. So 17, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, that is John, saying, come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. And the first thing that he does is he separates John, he pulls him aside, and he says, come up here. And what he's doing within the text is he's separating him from the world. Now, this to me is the picture, once again, that we're getting not only in chapter 18, where it's talking about you got to get out of there, but he's also given that picture, as Paul gave us that picture in 2 Corinthians 6, 14, 15, 16, 17 in particular. Come out of the world, you need to get out of there. The point is that you and I can't see things clearly until you step outside of this realm. Look, you're in the middle of it. One of the reasons why the church is called ecclesia, that means called out ones. Did you know that? So what we're doing every Sunday is calling you out from the world. And then what we do is we sit back with you and we go, okay, now look at the world from here. And when you can look at the world from here, you go, okay, it's not so good. When you're in it, you can't see it too clearly. You're so immersed in it, you're listening to the lies and you're believing them because that's all they're about. But we call you out and we say, let me show you what's about. And the description is not only making reference to the case that there's a forensic case, there's a case that God has against this great harlot. But if you look at the passage, he's actually giving you the case, the legal case, the indictment against Babylon. And the indictment is great harlot. See the text? Porne is actually the word that's used, which basically means that she sells herself for money. Yeah, it's just money. So to understand that people are so willing to sell themselves. I know people that won't go to church because they have to make money, and I'm going, why would you keep selling yourself? Are you up for sale? So what the world wants to do is it wants you to think in terms of, avarice and greed and all these kind of things, so that you would be pulled away from that which is really valuable. So the great harlot is one who is being indicted here, somebody that's selling themselves. And if you look in the passage, the description is who sits on many waters. Now, as we go through the description, each verse 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, there is an allurement that's being described in each of the texts. So the first allurement within the passage that allures not only the church, but obviously you and I as individuals, is the allurement of mass affirmation. The text reads, she sits on many waters. Now at this juncture, you don't know what the many waters refer to, but I cheated and I read ahead. And if you look with me in verse 15, you can cheat too. Verse 15, and he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are what? Peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So we actually know what they are. So the point of the passage is that she sits or she rules over many peoples. The emphasis is that you're dealing with mass. You're dealing with, we'll put it another way, majority. I guess we could call it two-thirds majority, because two-thirds of the earth are what? Right, are close anyway. So there's your two-thirds majority. I always wonder where that came from. But it has nothing to do with being right. You see, we think in terms of, well, wow, look at all the people. All these people can't be wrong. Well, they were with Noah. So it's actually possible for a majority to be wrong. So the emphasis of this is that this woman is taking her cues from the majority that are storm-tossed. The way that's put in Isaiah 54:11, oh, storm-tossed and discomforted. And that's a description of the sea, where the wicked are like the tossing sea. It can't be quiet because there is no peace for the wicked. And if, in fact, you reside over the sea, what are you taking your cues from? Well, you're obviously taking your cues from storm-tossed, discomforted, capricious, confused, undisciplined, volatile people. Let's vote on it. Well, it's not going to go well for you. But the allurement is the popularity, is the mass. There's a mass affirmation. And what the evil does is uses this to put pressure on people. I mean, you know yourself. You've probably walked in restaurants where you got some looks. And you could feel the pressure of the majority, couldn't you? You can feel it. You remember going to school, you know? I remember taking one class at Cal State, and it was a big class. It seemed like 1,000 people. I don't know how many people were there. But the professor goes, so how many of you would call yourselves Christians? Not one. Well, mine started going like this. I'm looking around. I'm going, there's nobody else in the class. Oh, my goodness. I mean, you feel the pressure. And you can understand why people cave so much, because that's a pretty powerful force, that mass affirmation. So the passage is describing all the way through what it's going to describe are the things that come. Now, what's interesting to me about this is that in many respects, it's going to parallel to one of the seven churches. And one of the interesting things about the Church of Sardis, which if you remember reading about the Church of Sardis, I know it was a while back, but if you remember reading about the Church of Sardis, what you read is specifically, they are concerned about having a name. And it's about mass affirmation. And God is saying, you may have a name, but it doesn't matter, because I'm against you. You know, as a church, we shouldn't buy in to the allurements of the world. The world is trying to allure us to think like them so that we not only become marginalized, ultimately, so we just shut up. And it's moving in such a way that there's these pressures that come upon us, but we cannot think like the world. So the first thing is, sits on many waters. That's the emphasis of the passage. Now we know that the description of the world has already sold itself out. Not wanting to do the right thing, sold itself out to its pleasures, to whatever it wants. You know, the self-gratification, narcissistic desires. But that's verse 1. Verse 2 then goes in to describe even in more detail with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality. That's basically unlawful intercourse. What's the unlawful intercourse? The unlawful intercourse is that you've loved the world instead of God. You've loved the world instead of God. Once again, let's turn to James. It's just good to have these passages marked so that you can, you know, see the correlation between the two. If you look with me in James chapter 4, once again, the whole issue about just being upset, you know, talk about seas, right? Tumultuous seas. How does it start off? What's the source of your quarrels? Right? Your conflicts among you, your quarrels, your pleasures, wage war in your members. You lust and you don't have, so you commit murder. You're envious, you cannot obtain, so you fight and you quarrel. You obviously don't have any peace, so there's the tossing sea. You ask and you don't receive because you ask wrong motives. Watch verse 4. What's the problem? You're having a love affair with what? The world. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility towards God? You're dating the wrong girl, is what's happening. You know, you put a face on it, it gets more intense. You know, if you just said, you know, you're getting mixed up with the world. You go, well, so what? But you say, you're dating another girl, and you're married. Okay, that puts another face on it. And that's what he's trying to convey within this particular passage of James. And what we're seeing in chapter 17 is that the world has sold itself out, and it's trying to get you to do the same thing. And it's by mass affirmation or by presiding intoxication. Because the passage then goes on to say, if you look in verse 2, from who the kings of the earth committed, that's presiding, that's authority, those are forces that are, you know, often influential, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell in the earth were made, watch the way it reads at the end, were made to what? Drink the wine of her immorality. Now he's describing a presiding intoxication, that you're intoxicated, you're getting drunk. That whole thing of addiction is an interesting, I think, in many respects, an interesting metaphor for sin in your life. This is why Ephesians 5 uses it. It says, don't get drunk with wine. That's dissipation. You're just wasting your life. But it becomes a metaphor, that drunk with wine becomes a metaphor for any sin that is intoxicating to you. And the experts have in their observations realized that intoxication has certain signs to it, and more specifically, addiction kind of creates certain ways. Three things in particular they mention. One is one of the signs of an addiction is that you have an overpowering desire or need, overpowering desire or need, compulsion. Which when he's talking about this, you know, the earth was made to drink the wine of immorality. What he's basically saying is that they became obsessed. Compulsion came in. That, well, what is it that makes people want more? Well, maybe it's your neighbors. The Joneses have some. I need more. But there's something that begins to intoxicate, and before long, you have this overpowering, people just can't stop. You ever heard of workaholics? They just can't seem to stop because they can't have enough. It's kind of the picture of Ezekiel 27 and 28, where it's using Tyre as a description of the city that keeps going out and getting more. It's not satisfied with staying in port, and once again, there's that picture of the seas that is restless. You just have to keep going more out and obtaining more. And of course, it ultimately becomes a picture of Satan himself. But it's that presiding intoxication that moves us. The second thing that they say that it creates is a tendency to increase dosage. In other words, not just satisfy with the original compulsion. You now want to increase the dosage. It just got to be more. And the third thing that happens is a psychological and physiological dependence on it. Not just physiological in the sense of the alcohol, but now a psychological dependence on, I do need it. Well, why do you need it? Because I've been doing this for a while, and this is what I do. And that dependence is that which becomes, well, intoxicating. The signs of these things, they say, is one, the inability to cope without it. Yeah. I don't think I can make the day without it. Why? I just can't. I can't. Or you have a problem, and what's the first thing you do? You have a problem, where's the first place you go? The world. You're intoxicated. Oh, I need the world. Why? I just do. I can't cope without it. There's a neglecting, interestingly enough, and an alienation from family and friends. Isn't it interesting how people will abandon their family and friends to make money, to go after careers? Well, that's one of the signs of addiction. One of the signs of addiction is you're unable to think or reason clearly. You do know you're wasting your life. No, I'm not. The fourth is you're unable to control or stop your destructive behavior. I wish I could stop. Why don't you? They say there are actually stages in stopping. First stage is you're plagued with guilt. You know, I feel terrible. I'm doing this. I don't want to do this anymore. But what's interesting in that particular stage is you still rationalize. So though you're plagued with guilt, you know, but hey, I got to do this, right? I mean, there's nothing else I can do. I have no other choices, right? And that's part of addiction is you're involved in rationalization. The second thing is you attempt to change your patterns, but you still consume the same amount. But you're trying to trick yourself. Yeah. And they say the process is that you don't lessen your consumption, but you just change your pattern. But the third thing begins to happen is that what used to be just something that would be done at night now begins to happen in the morning, and then after that you begin to start binging, and then you know what the last stage is? Here's the last stage. You give up. That's the last stage. The world is trying to get us to give up, trying to get us to stop doing what we're doing. It's intoxicating us. It's moving us. So what it does is it puts us in the realm of this authority, this power. It's no wonder when Paul talks about your sin, it's like you're in bondage. It's no wonder that he puts it in those particular terms, because it's like authorities that are coming in and put you in bondage. And the world has this authority. Well, look at the passage. The kings have committed acts. They've already sold themselves. And now, they're trying to intoxicate the world with it. You sit back and you say, well, if these people do it, that makes it more intoxicating, doesn't it? The more influential the people are, well, you get movie stars, you get other people, and you go, these are people that we look up to, because that's the way you do it. I mean, in some people's lives, it's the experts, you know. But whoever it is, these authorities now begin to lure, and you have this presiding intoxication. In verse 3, if you look with me, in verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit. This is an interesting way that he puts this. He carries me away in the spirit into where? Into the wilderness. And the wilderness is this desolate, depraved, and it really is a picture of a deprivation of aid, of any kind of protection. Now the picture that he's wanting to give, if you look in verse 3, is that the woman, though sitting on a beast, is going to be deprived of any kind of protection or any kind of aid. So that's the picture that's given. If you look at the Ben begins to describe, and I saw a woman sitting on, and look at the description of the beast. Sitting on what? Scarlet beast, right? Right. So the color itself is a very interesting thing, because this color red and this word actually means worm. And it has it actually is more maggot. I'm trying to be nice about this. So it's a maggot. The word for scarlet, the actual word for scarlet, is the maggot bead that is crushed and it becomes red. And that's what they use for dye. I don't think it's a mistake that Satan is called Beelzebub, Lord of Lies. But what it's showing is the sacrifice and the waste of sacrifice that has been used to adorn this God that we have upheld, this city, this great, and this power the powers of the nations. And so if you look at the passage, it goes on, carry me away in the spirit in the wilderness. I saw the woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which of course the blood of the saints, you're going to see as we go on, has been certainly a part of, and the blood of mankind to actually have this on the beast. Full of, look at the phrase, blasphemous names, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now, if you back up, I'm trying not to get into too much detail with you, but if you back up into chapter 13 and you look with me in verse 1, here's the picture. And he stood on the sand of the seashore. There we are in the sea again, right? This ought to be telling you something. Where are the problems coming from? Yeah, the majority of the world that are restless. You think the world is peaceful? Then why are they going all over the place trying to get more stuff? Okay. So I saw the beast coming out of the sea having what? 10 horns and 7 heads. See him? Then he begins to describe like a leopard, like a bear, well, if you go back into Daniel, it's much like the nations that have been a part of the earth, the powers of the world, so to speak. So the same picture is sort, but this woman is sitting on the beast, full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, the emphasis of the 7 heads and the 10 horns, heads making reference to authority, horns making reference to power, is that you have a controlling 7 and 10, the fullness 10, 7 completion. You have a controlling intimidation. In other words, the authority is there, and all of the power is wielded there. And that's intimidating. And that's one of the things that is alluring in the world, is if you can get an intimidating force that is unquestionably in control, then you can't buck it, right? I mean, you got to ride with it. And you have this interesting picture of the world selling out, and then a force and a power that becomes, well, the very thing that it rides on. And it becomes very intimidating and forceful. You sit back and you realize. I think one of the great pictures of this is found in Isaiah 14, where it describes Babylon as a great oppressor. And God finally says, I'm going to take this oppression away from you. But that's alluring to the church in the sense of you get too much pressure on a church. I mean, you get lawyers coming after him and all kinds of things, the world coming out, authorities coming after him. And you're wanting to throw in the towel. The fourth thing, if you look in there, verse 4, is that you have excessive, in the passage, excessive affluence. And it's really a picture of tackiness or gaudiness. But hey, it's a lot of gold, right? So if you look in verse 4, the woman was clothed in purple, which, by the way, shellfish had to be crushed for that to happen. But it's obviously a picture of royalty has been granted to her, and scarlet, obviously, within the fact of much death has happened for her to be clothed and adorned, look, watch, with gold, precious stones, pearls, having in her hand a gold cup. You know, one of the things the world does very well is they make evil look rich. Just do, and it's one of the great allurements. I mean, if you can put gold around anything, then I'm almost automatically go, well, that looks pretty, you know. It could be a dragon, it could be a snake, it could be a look how wonderful that looks. Put a diamond in it, and everybody wants it, you know. So the point is that here you have abominations, unclean things, immorality, all looking alluring. Because, I'd like to say it's more complicated than this, but money's involved. And wealth and riches and affluence. And the excessive affluence and wealth of self-indulgence, the allurements of self-indulgence, it's almost irresistible. It is, in many cases. Now, it ends this way in verse 5, and upon her forehead, a name was written, a mystery, or the mysterious Babylon. Now, the reason the mystery exists and really is the last and final allurement is that you have a mysterious attachment. The passage reads, the mystery is the great mother of harlots and of abominations of the earth. A harlot has become a mother of the earth. And what's bizarre is the attachment to this, that the world actually sees this as something to attach to. And this lewd, unbridled overindulgence really is described probably in more detail in Ezekiel chapter 23. But the best way I can describe it is there's this inexplicable hold of endearment that people have with the world. Why don't you let it go? I love it. Do you know what the world is? Do you know what they're doing? You know how they're using you? Yeah, but I love it. And you go, that's a mystery to me. That's one of the great mysteries. Now the context of this, once again, is it's written to who? Seven churches in Asia Minor. And if you understand this, then you also understand that what he's doing within the passage is specifically warning these seven churches. So, for instance, when you're dealing with the church of Sardis in Revelation chapter 3, verse 1, he's warning them about the allurement of popularity, that the church will easily be sucked into the whole. I mean, I've actually known works in which they think in terms of, we got to fill these pews. And they do almost anything and everything to do that. And a church doesn't exist to do that. Now, should we be happy and elated over the fact that people come and receive Christ? Yes. And I would say, yes, the more the merrier, I'm happy. But they have to really want to love God in order for the family. I mean, yeah, I'd want a big family, but I'd want to know that they were wonderful kids. I wouldn't want, you know, to raise bad kids. So the point is that the world has so infiltrated the church that it's been allured into the thought that it's all about numbers. Well, of course, that wouldn't be true in our country, would it? Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, and that's what Sardis was all about. I mean, Sardis, you have a name for yourself. You're really wow. And God says, I don't like that. And we begin to understand why. Because the world is actually alluring through this. And you start focusing on numbers, you stop focusing on God. Once you start doing that, then there's no longer a desire and a love to lift him up. And quite frankly, not shortly after that, compromise begins to happen. Because it's all for the sake of the numbers. It's all for the sake of. So you read, for instance, in Revelation chapter 3, verse 17, about Laodicea. And you have this wealthy church, and the church says, I'm so wealthy, we don't even need God. We can handle it. We got money to do that. And they're not putting their trust in God. Well, you understand where that came from. I mean, the affluence of the harlot has come into the church. But the whole point of all this is, don't let this come in your doors. Because these influences are going to, you have Thyatira who's known, according to Revelation 2:20, who is known to be tolerant of evil. And you've opened your door to these things, and you have Ephesus that is harsh and overbearing, and you have this sense of authority just telling you what to do, and you have Pergamum that's opportunistic, and well, it's all about career-mindedness. You know, the Church of Pergamum was surrounded by unions, and unions were making decisions, and people were worshiping in union halls because, hey, they need a paycheck, so they couldn't not, right? I mean, that was part of the union way. And so, you know, John is writing to him. He says, you can't do this. You can't let Jezebel come in and start delegating what you're going to do because of your career. And the church is going to try, the world's going to try in so many ways to come in and manipulate the church and to get us off track. And this picture puts a face on it. This is why it's so important that you understand what Revelation is about. What we're seeing is the evil personified. And God is revealing this to us and is saying it's not just that you're taking money and putting it in a prominent place in the church. It's that you're now being sucked into the whole game of selling yourself. And you realize, okay, we can't let this happen. This is one of the reasons why the church has to take very strong stands on issues such as this, because this is where the world starts coming in and manipulating and taking us away from following Christ. You come to the wonderful gospel of Jesus Christ, and he comes, and you think there's a reason why he was born in a manger? You think there was a reason why little town of Bethlehem? You think there was a reason why the first people that really got to see him were shepherds and not the kings? Do you think there was a reason why he lived in Nazareth? Do you think there was a reason why the disciples that he got didn't come from the city but came from the rural areas? Do you think all along Jesus was demonstrating the pattern that it's about faith in God, and it's about a relationship? It's not an organization, and it's not an institution, and we're not trying to build great edifices unto ourselves. Don't get sucked into that. The church must stay separate. Come out from among them, be separate. Father, we come before you today, and we ask you to change our hearts. Lord, we are inundated with things that the world is saying that's just not true. It's not true. It's not true. Our relationship with you is what it's all about. And you, as we were reading earlier today, take us into green pastures and you restore our soul. You take us away from the noise and the hustle and bustle and the confusion and, as Isaiah so aptly puts it, the chaotic city. And you bring us into a place of rest. We begin to hear the gentle, quiet waters of Shiloh. And we realize that you came to give us peace. We realize that we can't think like the world. It's trying to get in the doors. We've got to be separate. And yet, Lord, help us as we go out into the world to proclaim this wonderful message of peace. That as we have come out and seen the truth and the picture has become clear, let us reveal that to those that are lost. With your heads bowed and your eyes closed, Revelation is speaking to you. It's speaking to me. It's telling us not to get intertwined with the things of the world, but even more than that, it's calling upon us to cry out, Lord Jesus, come. I want out of this place. This isn't my home. And it creates a longing for that which is real rather than that which is not only self-indulgent, but just a selling of oneself to things that are destructive. When we come together today, we come that you might be separate. I trust that as we've opened up God's word, the Spirit of God has been calling you. You pray a sunny place. you rise and sing this chorus of Sunday? Lord, you've got to change our hearts. We're not thinking right.
Change my heart, O God. Make it ever true. Change my heart, O God. May I be like you. You are the potter. I am. Hold me and make me. This is what I pray. Change my heart, O God. Make it ever true. Change my heart, O God. May I be.
Always helps me to have a picture. The Lord bless you.